XV Planus is part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
The sky was clearer than I'm used to seeing, but I didn't really, like, at that night, but I didn't really see anything that I didn't expect. And going through the still images on the time lapse, I didn't see anything either except those two red. But I think those might be planes, but I'm not 100% sure. The timing looks a little off, but I also, that's not a familiar area for me, so I don't know where the airports are and what the airline flight paths are, so we'll have to look that up.
Right. So out of curiosity, like those two particular images that you got with the red light stretching across, what time frame, like how long of a period of time do you think that is?
So it was a 30-second exposure, so each one of those images is a still from the exposures. So that single image was a 30-second exposure, which means that light moved from the spot it starts at to the spot it ends at in 30 seconds.
Then given its fairly straightforward trajectory, I would almost bank on that being a plane. Or maybe one of those damn black military helicopters that kept popping up.
I'm thinking it might be the helicopter because the intervals are longer than you normally see on planes. Like with a time lapse of a plane, it's like dot, 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 dot. These are almost dashes. It's like a long dash, a dark dash, a red dash, a dark dash. And with planes, it's normally a dot.
And there were no other lights recorded either. So it was just red, which kind of leans into that idea of it being that military one that kept going around. So
yeah.
For frame of reference, let's talk about that just for a second, and then we'll move forward in the chronological order. During the time that we were there for 4 days and some change, we saw a lot of low ground aviation coming around. So we saw a lot of helicopters. We saw a lot of smaller low flying planes. But the helicopters in particular stand out to me for obvious reasons. Like, we already know that there are boys over at the ranch. You know, Brandon's got his helicopter. But they've also had continuous run-ins with these stealth helicopters that seem to be circling the property. And I kind of think that's what we were seeing. And not just on one occasion, because there were a couple of mornings that it was just me, Todd, and Lisa, and Meg, I think you might have been there for one of them, but we still had this same black helicopter just making massive loops around the area.
I don't remember that in the morning, but I was a little out of it because it was hot, so...
Okay, you probably weren't there for that one.
But there was an evening, and I witnessed that.
Every night at one point or another. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there was the one that all of us saw together, which was a little ominous. So here's the thing. We're going to share things with you tonight. Things that may be hard to understand at first. Things that might upset you. Things that you may find hard to believe. What's worse than that is that even when I try to explain them to you, it won't matter. None of this will really make sense unless you were there. But I assure you, everything is true to the witnesses of these events. And you may be a skeptic. You know what? I respect that. Well, depending on how ethical your skepticism is, I suppose. All I can say is that if you haven't had that breathtaking moment when what you think you know about the world melts away, then I weep for you. Although there is a part of me that hopes that I can hold on to things like doubt, if I'm being honest. I think it all depends on what you're really looking for. But for me, oh yeah, this is it. I've been looking for this. The kinds of places that host all things, a part of the paranormal melting pot. You may think of this statement as a moody connotation to drive this narrative machine, but you're wrong. I promise, it's only going to get weirder. Welcome to XV Planus.
Greetings,
Greetings, friends and fiends, and welcome back to XV Planis, the podcast where we don't just talk about the paranormal, we put boots on the ground and pursue it in the field. Transmitting from the Black Lodge, as always, I am your host, Flood, and as always, I am very excited to be back here to dive further into the unexplained, the highly strange, and everything in between with you all. I hope you're all doing well out there as we shuffle off the last layers of winter to welcome the warmth of spring. Tonight we're going to dig further into our experiences in the Uinta Basin, but first I want to take a moment to acknowledge a milestone. Today, as this audio is tickling your earholes, XV Planis has officially been broadcasting for 3 years. While the journey, the research, and the story itself goes back to over 4 years ago, the actual premiere of this madhouse was in fact on April 1st, 2021. I'm incredibly proud of what we have accomplished here, and I want to share my utmost love and respect to the people who keep this project going, because I can't do this alone. And so, to the entire XV Planis team, and to listeners both old and new, and to all the guests and collaborators I've shared this experience with, thank you for being a part of this journey. Now, we waited long enough to get back to this story, so we're going to save the updates for the end of this episode, but be sure to stick around so you can hear about all the neat things that we have coming down the pipeline. Now, before we continue off from last episode, there is another event that took place the night before that I neglected to mention. We briefly mentioned this before in the previous episode in passing, but there was a light experiment performed earlier in the day involving a prototype random number generator built by Roger Pingleton of Streamside. And with that, I'm going to pass the mic back over to Todd, and we'll also hear about the generator itself from Jill, right after this brief message from our friend and occasional collaborator, Richard Haddam.
Hey, Richard Haddam here. You've probably heard me on Astonishing Legends, but now I have a podcast of my own, Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, where I talk about all the books I love, the stories behind them, and how they made me who I am. The first time I read the Amityville Horror, I felt like I knew the Lutz family. George brooding and moody, Kathy paranoid and somehow guilty, the boys fighting like savages, Missy hanging out with a ghost pig named Jody. Maybe that's the part I identified with the most. Not the pig. The feeling that they were all losing their minds. That's when I learned there are basically 6 stages in the life of every parapsychologist. Curiosity, investigation, doubt, acceptance, James Randi, and depression. A hole opened up in the wall of his apartment, and an insect-like being, the size of a tall man, but in the form of an enormous praying mantis, stepped through. Odd, even for New York. We're leaving the highway now. Have you noticed the paved off-ramp we took has turned to a gravel path, and now a dirt road, and now nothing at all? Have you noticed how quickly the sun sets here? It's too late to turn back now. Everything's closed for the night. Why not sit down? I'll light a fire. There's a story I need to tell you. I'm inviting you all to join me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Come for the books, stay for the frankly surprising amount of oversharing.
So speaking of pretty damn fascinating, do you remember the night with the random number generator where I was maybe that's degrees.
Yes, we were going to cycle back and talk to you about this.
Maybe that's degrees on a motherfucking compass. We're seeing massive hits on the random number generator. I don't know how it works, but it's like, hey, I'm shooting out these numbers, and they're all falling within a certain range. So I'm like, let me bust out my phone, turn on my compass, and see where we're at. Just like trying to see like what direction I'm facing at this point in time. And the random number generator hits like 117. And then it hits like 135. And then it goes back to like 117, 118, 119. And it just continues to hit within this range of numbers. So I'm looking at my compass and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. 117 is pointing at this point in the mesa. And 135 is this other point in the mesa. It goes up to 147, which offshoots the mesa a bit. But every one of these numbers is falling in the direction of potentially where the triangle is and where the anomaly is. So it's literally hitting just the edge of the mesa, that little finger that sticks out there. Every number was falling in that, no matter what. It doesn't really make sense unless it was trying to point to something, because the next night it never really went off.
No, it never did very much.
But it was super active that one night. And when I was like, oh, holy shit, this could be degrees on the compass, and literally every number fell right there on the edge of the mesa.
Was it also pointing at John as he walked back and forth smoking a cigarette?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
We tested that. We definitely tested that. Much like, no, we did a lot of diligence that, like, we don't really remember at the moment.
Jill? Can you talk a little bit about what the random number generator is supposed to do? That'll help explain a little bit more why it was so impressive what was happening.
Roger created it for me. I said the second prototype. It's actually the only existing prototype of that. When I talked to him yesterday, he said, please don't lose it. I wrote the program for it and I didn't make a copy of it. It's a little Raspberry Pi computer that has a LED readout, and it functions the same as Spirit Storybox app does on the iPhone. And this very small but very powerful computer is generating random numbers. And the numbers that it is spitting out are being analyzed to be sure that they are actually random. When they are not random, it assigns a score to that based on the probability of that happening. And then that's the number that is put on the display. So the way I like to explain it is when the display lights up that random numbers are no longer being generated, that's when the physics is wrong. Something has happened. There's something in the environment that is at a level that it is able to affect a computer running numbers.
Which would kind of lean in towards what we were experiencing, because it started to become less random and we started to get like direct callbacks of the same sets of numbers for a while.
Yes, because when we originally developed it, we noticed that whenever we were getting an energy spike, a cold spot, an EVP, we would at the same time see that the randomness decreased. We'd see a spike, in other words, that something was off. It's kind of, I don't know, a wormhole's opening up. Something weird is going on with the normal physics and statistical probability that's going on inside that little computer. That's the best way that I can explain it. So for it to get anything at all, it's beyond coincidence. I mean, you know, there's statistical analysis that's being done there so that we know that it is actually legitimate.
And for us, for almost an hour and a half, that thing kept going off.
Right. And it was going off before you and Todd started interacting with it. Now, the other thing that we know is that random number generators can be affected by consciousness. I believe that consciousness can be living or dead. Mediums and other people like that, they can affect like Spirit Storybox. That's what kind of birthed the Princeton Global Consciousness Project, is they had people sit in front of computers, and just by using their focus mentally, their consciousness, they could start to determine what the computer was going to do. So when we turned it on, it was definitely giving us hits that led me to believe that that place is where I like to think of, you know, reality is a little bit thinner there, because the places that I've taken it, and I've taken it a lot of places, and it doesn't always respond, but it did respond there. So there's something about that place that's just, it's kind of a liminal space, or you know, the veil was thin, or however you want to think about it. So there's something very odd there. But then when you and Todd started interacting with it, it's not really clear to me, and I have no idea how we would ever figure it out, whether you and Todd are interacting with the consciousness that's controlling the number generator, or if it was your consciousness that, because you were also focused on it, that you were starting to determine what was going on with it. Because consciousness is consciousness.
That was intense. And it was reacting to all of us, not just one person in particular, but anybody who would speak to it and say, like, all right, give me a number, or, you know, do something. It would react within a span of like 10 seconds.
Yeah. So there was definitely something going on there. There was definitely some type of focus, which I think that the experiments that we did were really kind of interesting, because I don't know that anyone else is really doing more meditation and more kind of focused thought or that type of work there. Because that was basically, you know, what the pyromancy was about. It was just about, you know, turning your focus and your thought. And, you know, that's typically what CE5 groups do. You know, when they're making contact, that's what they're doing. They're doing it from a meditative state or from, you know, a particular brainwave state.
There were a lot of interesting hits on this experiment. But as Todd suggested, maybe, given that they are sent in three-number sequences, could that be associated with coordinates, latitude, longitude? At one point, Todd even suggested that we correlate the repeating numbers with compass dial details. In retrospect, I wish we would have had that epiphany to gather more data while we were still on the property, but hey, one more reason to go back. Okay, so now that we're all caught up, we can get back to where we left off last episode. We had packed up what little equipment we brought with us to the hilltop and made our way back to the base. The whole campground had grown quiet by this point. What few other guests that were camping on the ground with us had all doused their fires and shut off their lamps. The heat of the desert had completely dissipated and the crisp, cool night air descended upon us. We made it back to camp to settle in and relax around the fire for a bit, and it was around this time that Meg suggested that we try an experiment, something of a hybrid of things that we had already planned earlier. So let me explain the evolution here. It was our initial plan that evening to perform a CE5 experiment, but we ended up changing the format of that focus. For those unfamiliar with the CE5 protocols, that would be close encounters of the fifth kind, which is defined as human-initiated contact with UFOs or whatever the hell they really are. The basic idea is to get a group together to try something of a deep meditation experiment, attempting to collectively use their will and their consciousnesses to connect with the entities. If it sounds crazy, I get ya. But don't knock it till you try it. Don't tell me you debunk it, unless you've actually gone out and funked with it. You know what I mean? However, rather than focus our attention to the skies, Meg had the idea of collectively focusing our consciousnesses into the campfire. Using slow-motion camera techniques, Meg set herself up to record this session with the purpose of capturing details of the fire while we collectively tried to manifest an image within the flames. After some discussion, it was decided that we would hold the image of a buffalo in our mind, a simple but meaningful image to hold in our mind's eye and focus on. We cleared our thoughts, nothing else but that buffalo. The session was a success in its way. There was very much a palpable cone of silence the more still we became and the longer we gazed into the fire. For me personally, I sank into a meditative state with great ease within minutes, but somewhere around 25 minutes after that, things started to change. I felt like my state of consciousness shifted from one of focused meditation into a hypnotic trance state. At this point, I leaned my mind in to the roaring fire and got lost in the rhythm of the flames. There was a point where I felt a heavy jolt into a state of dissociation, similar to that which one might refer to as an ego death brought on by a hallucinogenic experience. The fire eventually took me over, and I was lost in its flashpoint, my peripheral vision vibrating and flickering with shapes that didn't belong there. And at this point, I'm diving into journal territory here, but maybe I'll come back around to what I was seeing towards the end of this. But if you pay attention, you'll pick up on what I'm putting down anyway. Anyways, Meg did manage to capture some captivating images that, to you, will likely look like nothing. For us, however, well, why don't we get to that?
And if you're interested in seeing any of the images that we were about to mention, you can check out the XV Planet's Instagram and check out our post from July of last year. For your convenience, I'll also share these images on both the IG and Facebook stories for reference. What follows is a kind of disjointed collection of conversations about that meditation experiment, as well as a few tangents from the lot of us.
It was a really interesting mix of ingredients in that particular pyromancy. And Megan was the one that came up with that. And I thought that was just like the coolest thing. I am always all about anytime you have a fire, make it sacred. So I had brought a lot of leftover candles from my workings, like all of my positive workings, and had been burning those in the fire. And then we had gone to a magic store in town, and I had talked with some of the locals. And so I had added some sweetgrass and some other incense and things that she thought would be acceptable and appropriate for that location. So I think it was a positive thing. I think it was a welcoming thing. There may be some message there that we can't quite decipher, but it was a positive thing.
Go back to what you were talking about, Lisa, the image that you were talking about sharing with people that you could kind of see that smoke entity in.
Yeah.
Right off the bat, from the very first time that we started anything related to the pyromancy, to anything of that nature, to Meg doing the slow-mo photography, the first phrase that really stuck into my mind, and I could not shake it for the rest of the time there, was the djinn. And this really stood out to me.
Yeah.
Djinn or elemental or something of that nature. That really stood out to me. And it made sense, especially, and I'll go into this in greater detail during a different conversation on this series, but what I was going through as I was doing the staring contest into the fire for the pyromancy experiment, that's pretty close to what I was seeing within the flames. So to see it outside of that and projected in a manner of smoke was a little shocking to me.
Right. So one of my chefs at work just recently came to me and was like, what'd you experience? He's French. He has a lot of experience in the military as well. He's like, why did you see a djinn in Utah? I'm like, well, you have to understand, maybe we're just messing up the words.
He's like, that's how we describe an elemental energy from that area.
So he brought to me, he was like, maybe you saw an elemental Native American spirit that you mistook as a djinn. He was like, because you have to understand, in his esoteric practice and when he started to learn, he explained more to me. He was like, no, there's no reason for a djinn. And I looked at him, I was like, well, if you want to look at it for a timeline, they've traveled for centuries. So you can't place a djinn just in Arabic culture. It's totally transgressed all that. It's in every continent. And he just kind of looked at me the same. He's like, no, I really feel like that wasn't a djinn. I feel like that was the Native American spirit saying, this is your sanction. Whether it was wind, he doesn't think it was fire, but he was going down the parameter of it. I'm like, eh.
It's the same thing, though. It's just a different cultural interpretation of it.
That's much what like I calling would lean
the
towards,
same yeah. energy, the same consciousness.
Right. I mean, the djinn are known as tricksters. You know, you don't want to tick off a djinn. And in right. a Native American, it's coyote. Coyote is the trickster.
Yeah.
I think it's the same energy. Regional. It's and these.
It's just a different is. Region.
Yeah, it's very, very, very old.
But I do love the fact that he was so looking at the photo going, wait, you just what? Well, there it is. And he was so befuddled. He's like, dude, I don't know how I explain this, but I don't think it's a djinn. And he's arguing. I'm like, it's not the same nomenclature, obviously, mm-hmm. but it's the same entity, just regionally or culturally specific. And he thought I'm stupid. He was like, have you looked up the research? I was like, no, but we're going to talk about it tonight. He's like, I want to know everything. Cool. I'll send you a link.
Well, you be sure to tell your friend that the term gin can mean a lot of different things, and there are many different types of gin.
Yes, yes. He's so French, though. He's Pepe Le Pew.
This is, I'm probably, is he legitimately Pepe Le Pew?
No, he's Alsatian, so he's worse.
Alsatian.
Oh, okay. All right, yeah, because unless he's actually flying on his tippy toes as he's smelling cheese, then I don't buy it. Not for a minute.
Wait, you're not supposed to do that?
Yeah, but, you know, you are a cartoon, Walter Skinwalker, so that's exactly
what
I would expect.
Not the first time I've ever been described as a cartoon.
So the thing about the gin is, and I know that there's a handful of people out there in the paranormal world who are really going to get a chuckle when I say this, right?
Yeah.
I think the gin get a bad rap, kind of like pit bulls do.
They do.
Yeah.
They're not always malevolent. They're generally benevolent.
Yeah.
They're a product of their environment. That's it.
They are playful, and they will react to people depending on what they are putting forth. I think you're absolutely right about that.
But you find the wrong one, and they mess you up bad.
True.
Same with chihuahuas and dachshunds.
Yeah, exactly.
The most dangerous dogs in the world.
You can find all of the dogs. You just have to disrespect the wrong one once, and that's all it takes.
They'll only fuck with you if you fuck with them first. They generally will avoid people and want to be left the fuck alone.
What, pit bulls or gin?
Both.
Yeah, I mean, there's an old Arabic saying that, you know, you just, if you're a man, you don't pee on bushes out in the desert, because you might accidentally pee on a gin and then you've really ticked them off. Then they will.
Sorry, buddy. I drowned you. I am so sorry.
So it's Todd's fault.
It totally is Todd's fault.
I was trapped.
I don't know. It almost seems like they'd be on par with, like, you know, the Fremen and Dune. And thank you for your water, you know. But, you know.
You got to recycle it first.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's fair. That's definitely what stood out to me whenever we were doing those experiments and what I was seeing in the fire in the first few still frames that we got from that slow-mo experiment. That really was the first thing that popped into my mind. And what I found really interesting is, without me even mentioning it, after the experiment was over and everybody was just hanging around and talking, Jill actually started to talk about specific types of entities and started to hint towards the djinn before I even brought it up into public conversation, which I just found to be pretty damn fascinating, if you don't mind me saying.
I have two things I really want to talk about. The one thing is, there's a photo Jill gave me, or maybe Megan did, but it was a visual representation of someone in smoke in Lotus, like this, head down, kind of a horn stance.
Mm-hmm. That was the last, it was the last frame from the slow-mo of our pyromancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still stuck on that. So I actually went back to work. I talked to people at work, and I asked them, what do you see? What do you see here? And the biggest answer I got back was, well, that's a spirit energy. That's manifestation of the earth or wind, not fire, because the fire wasn't represented in that picture. So maybe air. But I'm still stuck on that, because it wasn't an ill feeling. There was no negativity associated with it, but it was very visually represented in the photo. I'm still digesting that. But the biggest thing I'm really digesting is when you and I went out on the mesa, because when you cross that barrier of the gate, it's not a heavy rock base. It's a heavy silt base. So I could dive my feet into it. And I remember talking to you about it, because we knew there were scorpions about, and I was like, maybe I'll just do this for a little bit. I totally gambled with the risk reward. I was like, all right, fine. The energy, though, it's a conduit. It runs just like the body does. that's something that I found really of merit to kind of marinate over, because I really don't know what we experienced out there, but I know you and I were very much in the same scope, trying to visualize the same portal. And I don't know, I'm just still working on that one.
So as a soil scientist trained person, like I took soil sciences a lot in college. It's called ground for a reason.
Yeah.
It's full of negative ions.
Yes. It's legitimately, you're connecting into it when you insert your feet into it.
That can actually be scientifically measured.
Yes, 100%.
Earth is ground for a reason. You literally can measure that. It's a whole science of grounding. People are sleeping on, you know, that's why it feels good to sleep on the earth, sleep on the ground. Yes. They're trying to duplicate that with, you know, these mats that you sleep on. It's really, really powerful there. Speaking of ground, the one thing that we haven't discussed in this forum are the fire ants. So it just for your listeners, you know, we're the whole campground, the whole area is in the Uinta Basin. It's literally a basin, and then the mesa is rising above it. And the campground is fairly low. There's no cell service in the campground. And so this area that we're talking about, it's like a little hill. So you go up this little hill and then it's flat on top. And that is sort of the entrance way to the mesa. It's fairly flat. And then as you proceed along there in the UTV, that's how you get up onto the mesa. So it's sort of literally like a stepping stone plateau kind of mesa area. So it's still got rock in it. And like we're talking about, there still is an awful lot of dirt. It's still kind of half dirt, and it's just kind of transitioning to rock, I guess is the way I would describe it. So in this rock area, which we kind of referred to as the rise, and this is on the inside of the gate, the people who own the mesa, there is a gate there. And we respected the gate, and we stayed on the UFO campground side of the gate. That is the area that we're kind of talking about. It just has a really weird vibe. I felt it from the first time I was there. I only discovered that rise because I was trying to get cell phone reception. And Jody had said, well, you know, you can try maybe going up a little higher. So I climbed up there, and yes, you can get cell phone reception there. And I felt really creeped out, but it also felt like a special place to me. And so I walked a little closer to the gate and then to the right. And that's where there's a large rock outcropping, which when you stand on it, you actually have a really good line of sight, probably to the sacred spiral, which is on the mesa and everything else. Well, that's the area where I left offerings when I was there in September. It just felt like the thing to do. And then that's the area that Jody told me later that's where other paranormal groups have seen these black shadow figures kind of rise up from the ground and sink down in right in that area. So when we got there, I took Lisa up there and I said, I want to show you this area, see like what you feel about it. And I brought tobacco to make offering, because I always do that. We are such intruders on that land. So I just always show respect. So I went and left tobacco there, and to my surprise, I couldn't even leave it where I left it before, because that huge piece of rock is now the largest fire ant hill I've ever seen in my life. And I live in Florida. It's
super absolutely protected, huge. Yeah.
And they have burrowed underneath. So they now occupy that entire rock outcropping, because you could see they were coming in and out between the split and the rock. And they had built their mound on top of it. And I thought that was really, really interesting.
Referencing something that we were talking about earlier, I find it important to note that the same area that you're talking about, Jill, is the same area where Todd and I were witnessing the moving shadows.
Yes.
And where we heard those first few very large sounds of something thumping into the earth. So I just,
and you also heard like breathing or something, didn't you? When you guys had all walked up to the gate, you had on at different times, you were saying you were hearing things like in one ear, like just yeah. little weird. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, I was hearing stuff that when I approached the gate and then I followed it, followed along it and got towards the end of that area of where it dropped off. Yeah, I started to hear some heavy breathing off in the distance, and then some movement on the rocks itself, and it didn't sound light. It sounded heavy.
Heavy.
But never visually caught anything at all.
Yeah, I think that area is protected for a reason. That to me is just definitely feels really, really sacred, because it's kind of the, I guess it feels like that, like the boundary, you know, it's sort of, you know, like when you have the sand of the beach and then you have the water of the ocean, you know, and if you dream about that, that's your unconsciousness. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where your consciousness yeah. meets your unconsciousness. It's kind of like a boundary area. That area kind of feels like that to me. It feels like a liminal space, and kind of the more you go into it, I think the more so it feels like that.
Yeah.
I think that's why we see things kind of, you know, kind of manifesting there, either up out of the ground or, but that is all very earth-based.
Just between the images that I saw in the fire and what happened during the actual pyromancy session, the first go round, and the things that I was seeing within the embers, a lot of it was intense, but I agree with you. None of it was really negative. And a lot of that kind of feeds back into what I think about the phenomena as a whole is, bit of a psychical mirror. Like if you're bringing toxicity into the situation, that's what you're going to get back. If you come into it with a, you know, cleaner state of mind and open heart, it's going to be very, very different and a little bit more engaging, I think.
Especially that place. I'm just going to say, please do not anybody go to that sacred land and be an ass. Just please go with so much respect. Just tread lightly. You know, you provoke or you do things that you should not do there, it's going to spank you. It's going to spank you pretty hard. That's my feeling, is you have really got to have some respect for that land.
Now, Meg, when the pyromancy thing came up, that stemmed from you. And I'm curious, was there something that triggered that made it stand out as a good idea to you?
I don't think so. I've just been taking slow motion videos of fires for as long as I can remember. And I always thought they were really interesting to look at. And then we were going through the images and, you know, you guys were doing your thing and I was recording. So I actually will need to talk to you guys about that, like specifically what you are looking for. So I know when I'm looking through the files, if anything showed up. I just messing around with my cameras and slow motion videos of campfires are interesting to me. So
fair enough. I would say like with that first session, the thing to really look for would be the image of a buffalo. That's what we were all focusing on. So if anything that resembles like, you know, horned beastie, yeah. It might not be Satan. It might just be a buffalo.
Well, that image we got, it definitely had horns.
That is true.
It had horns. So perhaps
that was before that though, because that was the first one. That was before you guys did the buffalo thing.
No, the very first one we did was a buffalo.
We did the buffalo.
Was it?
We did buffalo.
Oh, I thought
and
that.
We kind of said coyote.
No, the second night was more of a free-for-all type of thing. But that first one, because you remember I sat down and I said, rather than trying to ask it questions, let's try to focus our energy on it and pick an image. Let's see if we can manifest the image collectively. And we all went with buffalo. And that's a really good point. I mean, we did get the flame with the horns. Now I'm curious as to whether or not there's some more detailed images of those flames as we keep backtracking through it. But the smoke that came off of that particular image also held a pretty impressive image, at least for us as we reviewed it.
I see it as some type of a shamanistic spirit. I showed it to a practitioner of Native American religion, and she thought that it was a shamanistic spirit.
As I've expressed to you, I felt like I was picking up on something that was a little bit more along the lines of elemental. You know, the title of Jin definitely popped into my mind a few times. And after the session was over, you even made a few comments that kind of leaned into that direction, and that kind of solidified it for me. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know what's out there, but, you know, as you said, it's not just the ground or the sky. It's all of it.
It's all connected. And I think we were trying to connect with like the spirit of the land. So yes, that would be elemental. And yes, that's how the shamans there, you know, have drawn their power for however many hundreds of years. So I think it's all connected. I think there's a reason that, you know, buffalo are sacred to them. It's just all part and parcel of the same thing.
If that seemed a bit all over the place, you are 100% right. The full uncut interview for this series is over 4 hours long, and yes, we get lost often. But there are some highly interesting side stories that happen throughout the whole trip, and at times, it's kind of hard to keep focus. Call it paranormal ADD if you want, but the truth is, there are things that happen on this trip that will not be shared on the main feed. Some of it is a bit more personal, and some of it I need to carefully curate on channels with full public access to protect myself, my team, and our hosts from any backlash. And that, my friends, will become very apparent in the final episode of this series. If you want to hear the considerably longer, mostly uncut versions of these discussions in the meantime, including some of the experiences that I'll share only with our subscribers, check out our Patreon at www.patreon.com/xvplanis. But don't worry, I promise you're getting the more important bits here. After this experiment came to an end, the crew retired to their tents, finally succumbing to several days of travel and the first 2 days of high excitement just for being in the basin. Even now, the trip was worth it. I've already experienced phenomena I've never come across before, had new variations on those that are familiar, and we were only halfway there. Day 3 would bring even more strange experiences, though that would even pale in comparison to the last 8 hours on the property. We'll start to uncover that and much more right after this brief message from our friends over at the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Jason. And we're the hosts of Grognostics, the podcast.
Take a journey down the rabbit hole with us as we investigate some of life's most intriguing mysteries while sampling some of the country's finest craft beers.
Some topics would include UFOs.
What the heck was that?
What?
Oh, that spaceship. I got some sound effects for our promo. Pretty sweet, huh?
It's a little annoying, actually. Where was I? UFOs. Oh, the disappearance of the Roanoke colony. Seriously, Steve? Foreign accent syndrome, reincarnation, mediums and psychics. Nothing? Well, that's better. Cosmic quandaries, sex in the ancient world. Okay, that's it, I'm done.
You can find the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. That's Grognostics, Grognostics.
As the sun rose on our third day at the UFO Valley campground, the heat started to take its toll on us. We opted to head into town to eat at a local restaurant and take advantage of showers and air conditioning. We made our way back to the camp late afternoon, just after the sun had finally started to drop and the climate became easier to manage. Most of the third night was pretty calm and quiet, and once the sun had fully set and the deep, dark majesty of the desert sky at night took over, Jill was inspired to make her way back up to the ridge above camp for some observation, where we had already seen some activity on previous nights. Now, regarding that third night, Jill, that was the night that you decided to trek on up to that upper level and kind of set yourself up there, and you set up the laser grid and the little Evo doorbell thing. Mm-hmm. Let's touch on that just for a minute, and obviously we'll go back and do a much deeper dive into all of this stuff a little bit later. But as you said, just to make sure that we document a little bit of everything here. That one was interesting to me, in particular, the doorbell thing going off not too long after you set it up there out of the blue. The reactions that we were getting from the laser grid were pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, we were definitely getting movement in the laser grid, and it was like fairly random movement. I mean, the wind had started to pick up at one point, but that was like just prior to that. And it wasn't, if the wind is blowing, it's going to blow, and it's going to blow across the whole grid. So I would imagine that all the pixels would light up, or you would maybe see it kind of come in waves, you know, depending on which direction the wind was coming. But this was just kind of, you know, randomly things popping up. So it was interesting, but, you know, once again, you know, when you're doing an outdoor investigation, it's a whole new breed of animal. You know, that's the thing, you know, because I'm already making an equipment list for what I would do, you know, next time for an outdoor investigation. We clearly have to get everything right. Just get everything right. Everything needs to be up off the ground. I need to bring I had my little portable table last time I was there, or the previous time. I need to bring that again just so you can get equipment up off the ground. And, you know, because that grid is also sensitive to thermal changes, and we were getting thermal changes, but, you know, we weren't getting big, you know, temperature changes. So that's something that, you know, we probably should watch too, is just kind of, you know, use our thermal probes and just kind of see what's going on with that.
I would be really interested in reaching out to Jody and seeing if we might be able to get access to go back behind that gate. I mean, obviously not walk all the way up because we don't want to stir up anything, but a little past that barrier of the gate, I think would kind of open up the grounds a little bit and give us a larger scope of what to review, because some weird stuff was going on there. You know, whenever I made my trek down to the gate and then over to the side and then back again, I was getting the sensation of something kind of following like off to my left. And then I started hearing things moving in the rocks off to the right. Sure, could have been a prairie dog, but it seemed a little bit ominous to me, at least.
Yeah, it would be interesting to get another 50 feet further in there.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen where the laser ended, which was like just another 40 feet.
Yeah, and I think probably with that, the green laser is probably the way to go. I think we just need a really powerful green grid laser, and maybe not the dots, but maybe an actual like green square version.
I have been looking for that.
It needs a little more penetrative power.
If you happen to come across like a pure grid screw-on cap that we can break that up, please let me know, because I have a clamp that we can leave it on and leave it set. And the dot grid is okay, but an actual lined grid is going to be much better.
Yeah, and you know, in my bad, because one of the other prototypes we have is that spinning 360 degree green laser, and that would have probably been absolutely perfect. Because up there, I'm hesitant to use it a lot of places because it goes so far. But I think if we were up there, just at that right elevation, I don't think it would extend, you know, and be intrusive to anyone.
I almost think it would be interesting to raise it up higher than us. Mm-hmm.
We could just rent the whole campground and not have to worry about bothering other people.
Well, I mean, I'm talking, it would bother the people who are in that house off to the side. Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, this thing can shoot, you know, it can shoot for miles conceivably. So yeah, so there was that. And yeah, like Meg noticed that we found that those really weird hollow rock sounding spaces in the road right next to the gate.
Oh, and that's when I was back recording you guys, right?
Mm-hmm. It was me and Jill and Todd, I think. And I had my walking stick and I was just like pounding stuff because that's what I do.
Echo one.
And it was like rock, 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 hollow. And I was like, that's weird. And just started. And I was like, do you guys hear that? And they both also heard the same thing. So.
But we never got to the bottom of that, so to speak, huh?
I didn't feel comfortable digging up a rock in a yard that didn't belong to me.
Yeah.
Especially on a road.
They are good hosts. Let's not piss them off. So.
Well, it is the whole digging thing, too, you know?
You know, you say that, but I almost brought a little spade shovel with me just to do it.
I'm pretty sure I had one in my car.
Next time that's going to happen. I'm going to dig a hole.
If I could have pried it up out of the walk with the walking stick, I would have. But I just was like, this is going to require a little more elbow grease. And I don't own this land. And it's on the road. Like, that just seems, let's not make potholes for Jody.
I know, it almost made me wonder because, you know, sometimes farmers, they will actually, you know, bury almost like a metal span, you know, if they're trying to span something, like if there were, you know, big, huge gaps in the road or something. So we could probably ask her about that because it could have been something that had been put down and then covered over with dirt just so that they could access the mesa from there.
Okay, so that was the first three days or three nights there. Is there anything in that first set of 3 days that stands out to y'all that we haven't touched on? I mean, well, other than the surreal storms that we had to deal with.
I'm telling you, I had told you guys, I said the weather there is strange. It doesn't just move in like a front. It like stops, it circles, it you know, kind of goes around you. There's something about that basin. Just it's just strange.
Oh, it's the air currents.
Well, yeah. But I mean, it was like the lightning storm just went on and on and on and on and was like stuck there. And the only, I mean, I've seen that happen in the Uinta Basin. And the only other time I saw anything similar to that is the night that I had my first UFO sighting outside of Danville, Indiana. It was like this storm just would not like end. It wouldn't move. It wouldn't end. It didn't even really rain. It was just very much like that. It was just very electrical.
I've got a sneaky suspicion that we're probably going to find some more anomalies once we actually get done reviewing everything. I know that I have like over like 16, 20 hours worth of footage that I have yet to review everything on. But yeah, I mean, if nothing else, it's definitely wet my whistle. I want to go back. I definitely want to go back. Now that I get a better idea of what the landscape is, what you're dealing with there, yeah, now I want to go back and I want to amp it up. Part of the issue with, I think, this particular trip is, and it's not just me, like all of us were freaking exhausted. Everybody showed up already like limping. So everybody was just kind of burnt out. And so really this whole trip kind of descended into a hell of a great social get together with my favorite people, which I'm not complaining about at all. The next time we go back to be able to prepare ourselves, and I think for my own sanity, I'll fly in and just cough up the money to bring the equipment with me just to reserve a little bit of that energy, because by the end of that trip, like everybody was just burnt out, you know?
Oh, we're forgetting something very, very important from the third night.
What's that?
We saw we thought was a drone launch on the mesa.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not want to dismiss something and go, oh, that was just a drone. Oh, this or that. Because, so I gave you my little map. And the reason I gave you that little map is, and you can show your listeners too, so that when you're at the campground, you're actually looking at the point of the mesa. The bulk of the mesa continues straight in front of you. And I believe the mesa is about 400 feet high. So my point being, we saw that red and green light that launched straight up. And I'd say it went, what, maybe 400 feet directly up. It seemed to go up as high as about the height of the mesa.
Might even say closer to 6.
Okay. But I'm saying if you look at the map, where we saw that launch from is essentially in the center of the mesa. And I must say once again, the ranch that shall not be named does not own the mesa.
Yeah.
And for them to access the mesa, they would have to have either gone through camp the way we did on up, or it's a hike up the side of the mesa. The topography there, I really wanted to kind of belabor this point, because You know, they do go on. I do believe that they do go on the Mesa and they do things, but I believe that they are climbing up. They are not taking the route that went past us through the gate and on up to the Mesa. So the placement of that was very suspicious. We didn't hear anything. We didn't see anything else, any other lights, anybody using flashlights to scramble up there. Just, we see this incredibly intense red light shoot straight up, come straight down. End of story. Nothing else happened.
Yeah, if I'm looking at the layout here, then where we were looking, all right, so looking at this one, which that doesn't really show up. So the first map that you sent me that's a little bit more localized. So
yeah, that was the localized one.
Yeah, the far left side, you have the UFO Valley Campground. And then on the far right, you have the Skinwalker UAP landing zone. Mm-hmm. That first, the third night when we saw that first drone, if that was a drone, lift up and down. If you do a direct line of sight on that map from the UFO Valley Campground over to the triangle, then that light should have popped up somewhere in the middle of that, which is, as you stated, right in the middle of the Mesa. Like right in the middle.
I believe so. Yeah. The campground. Yeah. Now that campground, that pin that I dropped, that is focused like right on their house and on their office. So I believe we were actually a little bit, I don't know what I didn't, I was going to orient the map to direction. It's a little bit further down the page because I think it just shows up with that big green space, but yes, it would have been within the Mesa.
Now, everything that happened on that fourth night after everybody else was gone and I witnessed them doing their experiments, the big circular lights would have come from the triangle area.
Mm-hmm.
The rocket would have come from the Skinwalker Ranch area.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this whole other series of lights that was, yet again, coming up kind of like right in the center of the place. So I don't know what was going on there, but I just wanted to mention that just for the...
Could you try again?
God, leave me alone, Siri. Leave me alone.
Did you guys notice the direct line of sight from our campground? Like if you look straight from where our campground is, straight across the Mesa, that is where this the circle is.
The yes. Triangle.
Like the sacred circle.
No, the and sacred so, circle. Yeah, we were.
Oh,
we
yeah,
were
okay.
In
a direct
I see. Line of sight.
So legitimately, even like Jill's saying it's coming up from directly from the middle of the Mesa, it could have been coming even farther back, right? Because it was going straight up.
Exactly.
So we don't have any way to tell how far away from us it was. So it could have been from basically the start of the Mesa anywhere along that line.
Yeah, that's a perfect point. Because yes, we didn't have any range finders with us. We have no idea the length of the Mesa where that was. That's a very good point. Because yeah, we were directly across from that, the sacred stone. And then just as a side note, because when we were up on that little rise area, we kept seeing all that light in the distance.
Yeah,
that light I believe was Vernal. Because Vernal, it's still a pretty big city. And we did have a direct line of sight of that over that top small edge. It's where I gave you that second.
Not too sure about that one. And the reason that I say that is I've got some night vision footage that is going to be very interesting. As soon as I can get it organized and dated, I'll upload it and share it with everybody. But
okay, if you go to the second map I sent you, I did the blowout.
Yeah,
just because,
I see. It, yeah.
Like I said, so I thought that was pretty interesting because that area now is where Bottle Lake is. That's where Watcher's Lodge and Bottle Lake is there.
Oh, Bottle Hollow.
Bottle Hollow, the lake, Bottle Lake, and then the tribal building is there, and then further back is the supermarket, and then Vernal. So I think we were getting some city glow there from Vernal. And I'm just talking about, you know, just a city glow in the sky. This wasn't, you know, the Mesa lighting up or anything.
Yeah.
But I know you're not a big fan of watching the show, and it really isn't about the ranch. But one of the interesting things that they had just shown is that they're capturing UAPs flying straight out of the Mesa, right out of the solid rock. So who knows? I'm just putting that out there. Who knows where these things are actually emulating from?
We woke to cooler breezes the next morning. A front had moved into the area, bringing a melancholic overcast to the campground, as well as some intense breezes and brief storm systems. The sky was illuminated, no, animated, with crooked fingertips of violet light. While most of us had taken to keeping our camp anchored in the face of a rather violent storm, Meg decided to set herself up and capture some time-lapse photography, which itself had some interesting anomalies. But this also leans into a broader discussion of something that has been happening pretty much through the entire trip. File this under things you need to check out on our social media pages, namely Instagram or Facebook, because I am exhausted with Twitter, and Threads is meh, and Blue Sky just isn't there yet. But you can expect several photo bombs with the images discussed in the series over the next several days. But I digress, as our dear friend Janelle would say. That storm truly was majestic, even if we had to scramble to hold down a few tarps. This event ebbed and flowed over the course of the day and took over the better part of our afternoon. But between the family effort, Todd's amazing camp cooking skills, and a relentless sense of wonder, it was a beautiful day all the same. Once the weather had cleared up, our hosts at the UFO Valley Campground took us up to the Mesa for an exclusive tour of the ridge and the mysterious stone spiral as seen on Season 1 of The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch. Fun fact, they don't own that property. They were trespassing. Ha! That was a wonderful experience, and if you want to hear more about it, you can hear that over at the Patreon as well. But while it was a beautiful sight, it ultimately didn't play too much in the overall experience that we had at the camp. We returned to the camp just before sundown and started a fresh fire. Todd began preparing another one of his epic camp feasts, and some of us had begun slowly collecting our belongings and cleaning up, well aware that we all had very early mornings and extremely long couple of days of travel ahead of us. But the desert still had a couple of more surprises in store for us. Well, actually, just for me.
The only thing I can tell you is I don't generally hit REM. I avoid REM as much as possible. I had night terrors for a long time, so I've just generally evolved my life to where I don't get REM. I will say when I came back, and I'm just now coming out of this like really deep exhaustion, I never got to sleep comfortably. I didn't dream, nor do I generally dream, but I'm very aware of when like I've never had adequate sleep, even though I have REM deficit. And I told Todd this whole entire time, I'm like, dude, I just have not caught up. But I can't tell you what I dreamt, because I don't dream. But I can tell you that I'm not quite stabilized. Lindsay and I were talking about work today. She's like, dude, everything is fucking off. I don't know what's going on with work. I don't know what's going on with you. I don't know what's going on with me. But shit's not right. And I'm like, it's been that way for about a week and a half. So don't know really how to attribute that, but I'm aware of it.
So you would consider that to be kind of like a carryover symptom from your time in the basin?
Possibly. Yeah, possibly.
Okay.
I've been way more on edge than usual. I haven't done any yoga. I don't want to meditate. Like, I just want to kind of grind out things right now. That's not my usual. Like, I just don't want to touch base right now.
Anybody else felt off since coming back from the basin?
I haven't felt better.
You haven't felt better?
Seriously. Like, seriously, it was the trip that I needed to take. It was energizing. It's been a long time since I've been in the desert, but the desert never really leaves you.
Yeah.
It was nice to be back.
Definitely one of your happy spots. We already know that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, shit, I brought home cacti. I'm ecstatic.
How them cacti doing, by the way?
Actually, they're in our front yard now. I just went ahead and stuck them in the ground because I didn't have any cactus soil. They're okay. They're adjusting.
I have 2 points to make about this. The first, is you guys slept there. I mean, you all slept there every single night.
I slept amazingly well.
Donna and I went to the hotel. Megan was there some of the time sleeping.
I slept until the sun came up, and then it was too hot and I felt like I was going to die. And then I would drive back to the hotel and finish my sleep. So I'd get like 4 to 6 hours at the campground and then like maybe another 3 to 4 at the hotel.
So my point is that the people that were spending the most time there, you know, who knows what went on, you know, while you were sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I spent the night, and I spent 3 nights sleeping in the campground, they were the worst 3 nights sleep of my life. I could not sleep. I kept feeling that I was being watched. I feel a lot like Lisa. I don't remember dreaming. I just remember laying there constantly on edge, and I was terrified to open my eyes because I was sleeping in the back of my SUV and I had like this screen thing over my window. So I was getting air, but my seats, you know, are basically, you know, I'm right at level of the window. And I just kept, you know, I'd lay there and be like, I don't want to open my eyes. I don't want to open my eyes. I just felt like there was going to be some standing there when I opened my eyes. And I had one real bad bout of it where I had to go to the porta potty, and I'm, you know, and you saw where the porta potties were and you saw where the other campsite was. I mean, it was what, maybe 50 feet. I was literally terrified to get out of my car to go to the porta potty. I mean, and I did kind of one of these where I just kind of did like, okay, I'm only going to look right where I have to look. I'm only going to look straight down. I'm not going to use any peripheral vision. I'm just going to focus on going to the bathroom, and I'm just going to go in my car. And if there's anything around, it's like, I can't see you. So I really understand what Lisa is talking about there. But related to this, you know, I know, you know, I don't, with the whole thing with the show and everything that's going on. But there was some other information that came out. Now, some of it was revealed on the show and some of it was in that video I sent you, John. This gentleman has actually done MRIs on all of the cast members and all the people that are at Skinwalker, and they're starting to actually see physical structural brain changes. That these UAPs or whatever this phenomena is not good for human health. However, not everyone is affected.
It's not good for the wrong humans.
Exactly. I mean, they can't, you know, typically if something is bad, it should be bad for all humans. But, you know, on the show, it's the ranch manager there. You know, he got that huge lump that showed up on the top of his head. And then he had almost like an epileptic seizure at one point. Whereas, you know, Travis, you know, he received radiation burns, but this researcher has gone through now. So this is something that Bigelow was aware of. DOD circles, they were showing MRIs of some of the security consultants that had been there, you know, back in the Bigelow days. And one of these guys, his brain looks actually like Swiss cheese. They described as Swiss cheese. And so they think that maybe that is what's kind of pushing some of the stuff for disclosure, because these are scientifically, medically demonstrated, really catastrophic effects to the human, you know, neurosystem. So,
yeah,
I don't know. But, you know, they're affecting some people and affecting not. So I don't know if this is the UAPs or if it's just the, you know, the creepiness of the ground there, you know, some of this paranoia. I don't know. But that was a point that I wanted to make. And although I didn't have any missing time, John and I commented on the last night how early everyone went to bed.
Yes. It was very unusual, yeah. Yeah.
It was mass exhaustion. Yeah. Like, it was finally a cool night. The rain kept coming down.
Normally, I would agree with that, Todd, but no, it was weird. Like, coming from the one guy who actually did stay up, It was very strange the way that everybody, like a domino effect, was like, I'm tired, I'm tired, I'm tired, Jill, I'm going home, like I'm going back to the hotel and I'm tired, I'm tired. Everybody out, everybody just goes down like dominoes and super early. Like all of you were in your tents and unconscious before midnight even hit.
Right. Todd went first.
Yep.
Todd went first. Yep. Then Donna went to lay down in the car. And then I think Lisa crashed. Now I do understand, you know, we all had a massive drive the next day. And I know that that was kind of in the back of my mind.
I was drinking at sunrise.
Yeah. But to be honest, Todd, but the thing is, Todd, is that all of us had since sun up 3 days or 2 days before.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
That's the thing is like we didn't change our routine up or anything. Like it was all pretty much par for the course. So when everybody started to drop like flies at last night, it was significant to me because it was, even as it was happening, I was like, this is weird. This is really weird.
I mean,
yeah.
And it didn't really sit into places.
Got to get their energy from somewhere.
Well, let's do the timeline on that because I'm just Megan messaged me and I'm seeing a discrepancy. So Todd crashes out, Donna goes to the car, and then I think Lisa went next. So it was John, Megan, and I, and we set up to do another fire experiment. John plays, he did his singing bowl in a key of C to try to trigger some activity. He fell asleep, actually. I think John was sitting there. I think he was actually asleep sitting up for a while because Megan and I were kind of like, I think he's out cold. So we kind of let him sit there. So we did that for about 30 minutes. And then I played the tones. And then, as I recall, Megan was setting up her camera off to the side to do the 6 hour of the night sky. So I remember that being like around midnight or 12:30, because I remember thinking she wanted to do it for 6 hours. And I was thinking dawn was 6 hours.
Yeah.
And then she went to bed. So I was thinking that Megan went to sleep like around 12:30 or 1 o'clock is what I was.
No, 12:30 is pretty much on point because Jill, you and I were the last ones standing. Everybody else had gone to bed that night.
Yeah, I was thinking it was closer to 12:30 when we lost Megan.
You left at 1:15. Like yes, I remember that. So you were gone at 1:15 and it was just me for the rest of the night. Until I stumbled back to camp and found a semi-conscious Meg at around 3:45 in the morning.
Yeah, because John, we'd done the thing around the fire. We had done all that. Megan had gone to bed. And then we walked up to that little rise area. And I got up there first, and it felt weird up there. I didn't want to be up there by myself. So I kind of came down, and that's when I realized you were in the bathroom, John. So then I was waiting for you and then scared the crap out of you.
Yes, you did. No pun intended. Actually, pun very, very much intended. So scare the shit out of me, Jill.
Oh, okay. Megan is saying she was laying down. That's fine. I mean, I'm just saying these were people that were out of our eyesight because Megan had got to her and Donna was in the car. So, I don't know if they were actually asleep or not, but so then John and I went back up. I think he walked to the gate one more time and we were kind of watching for, shadows and things. And then we went back and then Donna and I left in the car for the night. And then the rest was all you, John.
Yep. Yeah. So from around 2 to 3 o'clock, everything is a blur for me. I don't.
You said really... you said you put wood on the fire.
Yeah. Before I remember went back after you left. I remember hanging around the camp for a bit. I threw another hunk of wood on the fire because I knew I was going to be heading back up the hill. So I wanted to make sure that fire was going. And so I went back up there. And what I thought was for approximately maybe 45 minutes. And then it turns into an hour and a half. Like I am actually missing some time from that night. And I'm still trying to piece that all together. I might be wrong about the timing somewhere. But I do remember
probably not
throwing the fire down, or like throwing the log on the fire, it picking back up. I depart. And by the time I come back down and I run into Meg, and Meg, do you remember what time that was that I stumbled back down to camp and you and I ran into each other?
Yeah, it was around 4 a.m. because I went and laid down probably around 1 because I had a headache, but right. I was awake until probably 2:30. Like, I remember hearing you put wood on the fire.
Yeah.
And okay. then
so this was I the last kind of like,
so yeah, that would have been in between.
Yeah. And then I dozed for a minute, and then I think I heard you leave. So I heard footsteps, and then I woke up and was like, oh, I need to go to the porta potty. So I got up and like was wandering that way as you were wandering back. And it was like 3:45, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, I asked you if you'd slept at all. And you were like, no. Nope. And I was like, cool. Well, as soon as you wake up, we're leaving. So get some sleep.
So at what point, cause you had said, John, that you heard a whole bunch of animals making noise, and you also felt like a wave of cold come through. Was that also upon arrival?
Me throwing the log on the fire would have been in between the two events that happened up on the ridge. So the first one, which I thought started around 3 o'clock. Lights okay. go up from their drones. And then as the experiment ends, this rocket goes off on the far left side of the mesa, like further off into that property. When that rocket goes off, there is a massive rolling wind that just unfolds throughout the entire mesa. And it was enough to, like, I could actually look, even as dark as it was, I could look off in the distance and see a wall of wind moving and kicking the dust up. So this wall expands and the wind, I mean, it easily drops everything down 10 degrees at the very, very least. After this wind rolls past me, I give it a few seconds and I just kind of listen to it. And then all of a sudden, you hear every cow, every goat, every coyote, every dog, every animal within the basin that is within listening distance, every single one of them starts to go off. Screaming, mooing, bleating, howling, all of it. And it was way... That was no coincidence. I mean, that was definitely a reaction to whatever in the hell happened on that ridge.
Yeah.
So they set off the rocket, their drones drop, the winds roll through, everything howls. Somewhere in between that and their second experiment is where I lose time. Like, I'm missing about an hour. And
interesting.
Well, I'll tell you guys something that's really, really interesting about that is that upon reviewing a lot of footage and discovering that I have a lot of audio files on my phone that I don't remember recording, apparently I spent about 45 minutes to an hour walking back and forth from the triangle area up on that top viewing area where we were hanging out, walking back and forth between there and the fence almost for 45 minutes. And apparently I was counting every step that I was making. Now I'm still trying to match all this up because I have roughly about 35, 40 minutes of footage and about an hour of audio on my phone that can all be matched up. But yeah, apparently I stumbled across something because I was walking back and forth that trek over and over and over again, trying to figure something out. And I have little to no recollection of this.
Interesting.
And apparently I can't count. No, it was really weird. Like, as I was starting to make the trek from the triangle area to the front of the gate, any time that I would start hitting the, 24, 25, 26 as I'm taking steps, I couldn't count. Like, I would start to lose my ability to keep count. And I had trouble moving.
So I think
it was really freaking weird. And I will share all of the video with all of y'all once I get it organized. But
I'll teach you how to keep a pace count.
No.
It was disturbing.
So something I think would be really...
Sure. 10 stones. You need 10 stones in one pocket. Every 10 paces you make, you move one stone to your other side pocket. So that way you have an accurate 100-step pace count.
I'm not You're sure if counting. You would have allowed me. Seriously, like, you got to see this. And it's more than one Hell time. Yeah. Anytime that I would hit to the mid-20s range, I found it very difficult to move forward, and I found it very difficult to keep count.
Keep it at 10.
So I think it'd be really interesting to see what the geomap is. Like, when we pull up our Google, like, where we've been. It'd be really curious to see what registers for you.
What we can pull up, because there's not much cell service out there.
Fair, but it would still...
It'd be different if we were running, like, sat phones.
Believe me, I've already been stewing on 1,000 different ways that I could repeat this experiment again, and I would very much like to, because the thing that stands out the most to me is what I'm hearing on the audio is that it took me 41 steps in one direction, but it took me 63 in another.
Ooh.
I mean, terrain differences, like going uphill versus downhill.
Not for that, like, small of a stretch.
No.
And it's all more right. than once. Yeah, so that's fucking weird.
It can definitely happen. It can definitely happen.
I'll send you the video and the audio, and then you can tell me what you think. Because I am still trying to wrap my own noggin around this shit.
I love being a skeptic.
You say you're a skeptic, but you've seen more than most, so I don't necessarily consider you to be that.
Fair.
Which version of Apple Watch do you have? Because I know with some of them, if you actually key that you're exercising, it will plot your course.
Your actual GPS coordinates?
It's 3.
Yeah, it'll plot whatever route you're walking while you're considering in exercise mode. I mean, it was higher up there. I had cell service once I was up on that little rise area there.
But that's the thing, is the distance from that triangle where the roads actually meet to the gate. I mean, and I walked it during the daytime. It was almost exactly every time somewhere between 39 and 41 steps.
Yeah.
But when I was doing it that night, it would be around there in one direction. But when I come back from the other direction, it was another 10 to 15 paces more.
Yeah.
And during this time, it was increasingly difficult to actually keep my focus and actually even keep count. I felt like I was losing consciousness the more that I was trying to push forward.
Right. I mean, granted, everybody's exhausted. There was a lot of sleep exhaustion, but what you're describing is a very repeating pattern, which I would think if you were just plain out exhausted, your mind can do weird things when you're, super fatigued, and we were all a little bit dehydrated constantly too. But that's weird. So why did you feel the need to even start counting your paces in the first place? That would have never occurred to me.
I don't know. I seriously don't know. But
I mean, that's like an OCD thing. I mean, is that something you routinely do?
No, it's just like an OCD
behavior. People will count. I that to me is not. That's just kind of odd.
I think I felt something odd as I was moving, like as I was just kind of wandering the area. I think I felt something odd as I was approaching the gate, and so that probably just inspired me to be like, "Well, let's try a few things.
In the military, we kept a pace count to know how far we'd traveled. For me, every 100 meters, I cover in 72 paces, so it's easy for me to track my distance by keeping a pace count. Why the fuck are you keeping a pace count?
Yeah, he's never been in the military. See, that's for
sure. Yeah, like, why the fuck are you keeping a pace count?
I don't know. Something just felt off there, and so I felt obligated to try.
That's how you're kind of grounding yourself. That's weird. That's really odd.
Hey, so Jack. When we go back next year, we'll duplicate the experiment, but we'll add some variables, and I'll keep a pace count. You keep a pace count. Like,
well, we might be able to
science the fuck out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we might be able to do something like an RFID tracker or something else to kind of get around the lack of cell service.
Yeah, like that is a huge issue. Like I don't even have GPS out there on any of my shit because I'm T-Mobile, of course. But
yeah, like, me too.
I'm sure we can get something that's more satellite controlled and like actual GPS trackers for everybody where it legitimately records where we've been, where we're going. Like
yeah, Megan's got one. She's got a GPS hiking tracker thing. She
hell yeah.
Bring, yeah, we're gonna I have just to go. We'll have to go.
Think
yeah.
to bring it.
Yeah, we'll have
bring
to go.
It.
Yeah, we'll have to go satellite, or maybe I'm thinking if there's a way that we could do like an RFID, or even do those person
like air
person.
Tags.
No, because well, no. Yeah, you could. We'll kind of go off Bluetooth, but there's another system that that hikers use. You go person to person. I can't remember what it's called. I'll look that up. Yeah, we need to kind of find a way to kind of track people and keep an eye on everybody and see where everybody's at.
Yeah. I mean, satellite would honestly be the most accurate. It would be the best.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Something just hit me. So when you said you were doing audio recordings up there, were you using the ER70 app?
No, I was using... just the audio recorder app on my phone because I wanted it to go longer.
Oh, okay. Because that will GPS tag you.
Oh shit! I should have used that.
But yeah, the ER70 does have it does have tagging. But it would be interesting still to look at any of those files that you did and see where they mapped to anytime you were in the Uinta Basin.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The following morning, the team said their goodbyes and departed for our long trips to our respective homes. But the story doesn't end there. There are parts of this that are extremely hard to relay through this podcast. I'm sure as you listened to that last segment, I was a little shaky, and I suppose this is par for the course when investing yourself in this kind of research and the potential for putting yourself in the path of something that you can't quite wrap your mind around. But this is only part of it. I've had to think about this, deal with this, and the aftermath of the Uinta trip for months. And when I say deal with, just because we left the basin, it doesn't mean that the basin has left us. There's still a bit more to this. So join us again in 2 weeks for the finale of our story on Uinta Basin, where I will go into much deeper details about the events on that final night, the strange things that have transpired since we left, and my hypothesis of what's really going on out there. In the meantime, if you're craving more XV Planus, consider donating to our Patreon at www.patreon.com/XVPlanus, where you'll gain access to our exclusive content. There's a whole other separate series on there, as well as extended interviews, exclusive episodes with special guests, and much more. A sincere thank you to all subscribers who support the show and donate to the Patreon. You are awesome, and I can't express just how much every little bit helps to make this go a little bit easier. Don't forget to follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, No I'm Not Calling It X, Instagram, Threads, Facebook, everywhere as XV Planus, and you can follow my personal misadventures and music projects at Folds and Floods on those same platforms. Links for both are in the show notes, as usual. Huge shout out to the UFO Valley Campground. This was our choice for lodging on this trip, and you simply cannot get a better spot if you're trying to get close to you-know-where. There's a link in the show notes for interested parties, but please, if you decide to go there, honor the rules and respect the land and its owners. They're wonderful people and offer a rare opportunity at an affordable price. If you'd like to contact me directly, you can email me at xvplanus@gmail.com, or you can leave me a voicemail at 770-410-8385. If you like what we do here, head on over to iTunes or Spotify to rate and especially review us. And tell your friends about us. Tell your families about us. Hell, yell at random people in election lines about us. We are a DIY independent production, and the only way that we will grow is by you sharing us with others who might enjoy taking this trip down many a rabbit hole. And friends, I don't ask much from my audience at all, but if you really do dig what I do here, please share this episode with your friends. Spread the word. Turn others on to us. It really is the only way that we'll be able to grow for a while. Be sure to check out all of the great shows on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network, like Lux Occult, Unearthing Paranormalcy, Camera Occulta, and more. You can check them out by going to www.greenmushroomproject.com.
The show is produced in the Black Lodge, wherever that resides in this particular moment of time and space, and is written, edited, and scored by yours truly. Music from the show can be found on my Bandcamp page for Folds and Floods or anywhere you stream your music. No part of this show or its music may be reproduced without consent. Copyright Folds and Floods Productions. Once again, I am your host, Flood. And this has been XV Planis. Thank you for being a part of the journey so far. And I'll see you in the between. In Abumbratio, in Fluctus, Sub Velo.